Right. So. Right, so we're getting down to it.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes,
on this Dan Ickick thing here, how did you... You have the Bessel function coefficients, which is fine and dandy, but... if you're going to use numerical results, how do you get this density, or, you know, that's out front with the G and everything, and I, you know, to plot this thing with real numbers, you know?
Well, it's relative to the...
Right, I asked you to plot it relative to the other thing, so you can set those numbers to 1 or whatever you want them to be.
Oh, great. Well, it would have been nice to know that. Okay. Thank you.
Right, so... I mean, that was why I had suggested in the problem just take V flat equals to the peak of the disk. So then it doesn't matter what you choose in absolute numbers the peak of the disk to be.
Yeah, you did say it in the lecture, but it didn't sink in.
Well, this is something I find students have problems with a lot in other courses, where I think I'm trying to make it easy by not making you grind through some specific set of numbers. Well, and it dulls the brain, apparently, right? Because that's not the important part. That only becomes important when you have a real application. But as far as learning, you need to understand what the functional dependencies are.
Yeah. Well, engineers like
I took the lazy approach. I didn't think of that. I was like, I don't feel like defining what G and stuff are. I'll just leave it out and be proportional.
Yeah, well,
so just be a little bit lazier.
It's the same.
Well, it was meant to encourage that. Right.
Well, engineers like real numbers, so we can make stuff that works.
Well, I can give you real data.
The concept is fine, but the application is what makes the world run.
Right, so this is the next to last class. Next time I would like to do the discussion I have been threatening. I have put some links on the website for things to read, so go read those before class next time. None of them are long or particularly involved, but just to give an idea of what the debate is right now. And so we will do that next time. Now, I seem to remember there was some desire for a review. Okay, so Wednesday at 11 here. Okay, so. So last class is Tuesday, we'll do the discussion, and we'll do a review Wednesday at 11, okay? Okay.
Wednesday at 11?
Yes. Same time, same place, different day. So the final is 1 week from today, Thursday, 8 a.m. The virtue of that being that we get done early. It's the very first time a final can be scheduled during finals week. And the review will be fresh in your mind. So yeah, we'll do the discussion next time, and if you have not yet, please do the course evaluation. Anything else before we jump in? Okay. So we had started talking about dynamical systematics. Yesterday I snuck out and went up to the dark matter meeting at Space Telescope, where there was a very good discussion of these things. At the end of the day, there was a panel discussion after the individual talks. I just went and looked, and they're webcasting all the individual talks, but not the panel discussion, which would have been the interesting thing. But you might check the website later, maybe they
it would be a good addition to preparation for the discussion, to listen to that. Now, part of the problem may be that they just didn't feel like they could mic up the audience, but you could at least hear the panel members speaking and responding. Okay, so dynamical systems. One of the things I'm trying to get beyond, as I said, is the barriers between physics and astronomy. So I talked a bit about physics, what the dark matter might be and how we might go about detecting it. On the flip side, the physicists who are doing that work seem to know item one here. Rotation curves are flat, and therefore there's dark matter for them to look for. But there's a lot more to the story than that, and so I want to inform you about that as well. And we had started in on this last time, so let me just go through it. Rotation curves are flat. We've seen that before. This is true over a big range of circular velocities, which you'll see corresponds to mass. So these are little tiny mass, low mass galaxies. This is a great big giant spiral, one of the most massive spirals known in the universe, locally. And we covered this last time, so I won't dwell on it again, though it comes up again later, that the inner part of the rotation curve is decently well explained by what we call maximum disk. That is, solving the Poisson equation numerically, given the light distribution, calculating what just the stars and the gas will give you for a rotation curve, that's that solid line, and then scaling the mass to the light ratio of the stars up until you bump into the rotation curve data, that's called maximum disk. Now, if you actually look in the literature, what people call maximum disk varies a little bit from author to author, because some people want to scale this up as far as possible. Some people try even to fit out in the rotation curve as far as possible, so they'll actually overshoot the inner data or hit the top of the error bars in order to fit further out. Other people want to leave room for a little bit of dark matter so that it's a continuous distribution. So if you ever actually work on this, you have to pay attention to what individual authors are actually doing. But the point here is merely that the stars are actually a good predictor of what's going on in the inside, if not on the outside. And here's that example again, where you actually see that predicted peak due to this little tiny bulge component down at the small radius. There is also this thing called the disk halo conspiracy, that there is no clear transition between the disk component and the halo component. The disk halo conspiracy was discussed a lot in the 80s and early 90s, and then, like I said, people kind of got used to it and stopped, just sort of accepted that they had to live with it, and so stopped worrying about it. Sort of like living in Japan with earthquakes. You know, it's gonna happen, but you're not gonna worry about it day to day. And depending on who you ask, there are sort of a couple of different manifestations of this so-called conspiracy. One is that the velocity due to the halo is comparable to that due to the disk. So here we have maximum disk. It peaks, in this case, around 150 kilometers a second, whereas the total velocity is maybe 170 kilometers a second, and is provided mostly by the dark matter halo once you get out to this point. However, the disk is still providing a fair amount of it, and so the halo is still down here, and those numbers are always comparable. Well, that's not fair. They're not always comparable, but they're often comparable. And a priori, it's not obvious that they should. Why couldn't the mass of the halo way, way outweigh the disk, so that the dark matter was way up here, or not? Maybe it's all stars on the inside, dark matter further out, so it's down there. So not obvious why that should be so close. The other is that there's no clear transition saying this is the disk and this is the halo, as there is for the bulge, right? You see this little tweak, it goes up, it comes down, goes back up. So that's the bulge, that's the disk, but then you don't see that transition again to the halo. So there's an extra component there, the dark matter, but
it is very good at not showing up in a way that clearly says on dark matter now instead of disk.
But if you were actually trying to calculate the total velocity of this guy, mm-hmm. wouldn't you not as you plot here, but wouldn't you take the some of the squares or something,
yes.
or to get the net velocity?
Yes,
indeed. And so when you would build an actual mass model, you have these different
right.
components, the stellar disk, and you might even have two components of the bulge in the disk, plus whatever gas is there, plus whatever you need.
Okay.
Now, there are a couple of ways of going about fitting this. One is to treat it as a big chi-squared minimization problem,
mm-hmm.
where you observe the distribution here, but you don't know its normalization. So this basically depends on the M to L, right? So you have the shape of the stalkers, that's that line, but you can scale it up and down,
mm-hmm.
depending on what the mass-to-light ratio of the stars is. And the other piece is the dark matter. You know, you need some, but how much you need depends on this thing. So you can try to minimize chi-squared and fit for both this and that. And what you find is that it's horribly degenerate. The value of chi-squared is pretty flat, and you can get equally good fits by trading off stellar mass versus dark mass.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I said before that for some rotation curve that looks like this, you might get disk and halo that look like that. That might be one fit. Or you could have disk and halo that do that. And as far as chi-squared is concerned, you're pretty competent.
Okay. Well, this applies then. I don't quite understand the meaning of this disk halo, because even though this contributions might be small in some galaxies or large, they're still additive. So what is this alleged conspiracy?
Well, that's a really good question. That's something that people have been asking themselves. And so if you're going to call something a conspiracy, and this was not my phrase, somebody else came up with it.
Sure.
Now, what do you mean by that? And so, as I say, sometimes people are concerned that this the peak of this disk velocity is so close to what you get to the halo.
Okay.
Why should they be in the same ballpark?
Oh, okay.
And they don't seem to be. Okay. More generally, the disk and the halo seem to know about each other. That is, how the dark matter is distributed seems to depend on how the stars are distributed. And it's not obvious why that should be. Right. You have the stars in some narrow disk, and the dark matter in some three-dimensional halo that's
mm-hmm.
much bigger. It's not obvious that they should be coupled in any
some communication
way.
Of the variables, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it's a bit of a, like I say, conspiracy wasn't my choice of words, but there's something there that's not well understood. Okay, so that's an individual galaxy. Now, if we look at galaxies as a statistical population, they follow various scaling relations, one of which is Toller-Fisher, which you've run into now, which originally was a relation between the line width and luminosity. The line width is when you take the flux integral of a galaxy, this is velocity along here, and flux this way, of the H1 line. And this is sort of an unresolved estimate of the rotation velocity. So that was how it was originally defined, because line widths were technically easy to get at. If you actually resolve the rotation curve, then you can define some sort of thing. One obvious thing is the flat level of velocity. And if you do that, the power law is about the fourth power.
And so that's what's shown here. Each point is now a single galaxy. This velocity is measured from resolved rotation curves, so just looking where it flattens out. And the mass is basically some guess at the mass to light ratio times the luminosity. And I went through this exercise of trying lots of different plausible mass to light ratios, and the details change, but the basic story stays the same. And the reason I was doing that is because once you get down to low masses, low velocities, you see the old fit, that line doesn't seem to work anymore. Galaxies start falling off of what otherwise is a pretty tight relation. But I also noticed that these things were fairly gas-rich galaxies, and it seemed to me that it should not matter to the physics whether the mass was in gas or in stars. So luminosity is basically being used as a proxy for the stellar mass. But you don't want just the stellar mass, you want all the mass. At least all the mass you know about. And so you can, if you do this conversion by selecting some mass to light ratio of stars into mass, then you can add the gas mass. And when you do that, it restores this relation. Okay. So we can see what happens as we go back and forth. These things are mostly made of gas, and so it makes a big difference whether you include that or not. This is a remarkably tight relation for extragalactic astronomy. Right? We don't get good correlations very often. Yes, sir.
Is this just something that we saw and put up, or is it something that was theorized first and seen? That's a question.
Yes, and I'm reviewing in my head the history because they are intertangled. So I think originally the Tully-Fisher relation was purely empirical. That is, we know Tully, who was a grad student here at the time, together with Fisher, noticed there was a correlation between the luminosity and the line. Just a purely empirical thing. People came up with theoretical explanations soon thereafter, one of which you re-derived on your homework. So yeah, definitely the relation came first, and is not something you would really expect a priori. And so this I call the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation, just because now you're talking about the baryonic mass, all the stars and gas you can actually see, rather than just the luminosity of stars. So that's an important systematic that you want to understand, right? If you go back to these mass models, you can play around with the mass to light ratio all you want, get different dark matter distributions. And if you pick the mass to light ratio poorly, then you introduce scatter here, which makes the relation worse. So it's not obvious that there should be a relation at all if that's what's going on. So actually something that people have worked on recently, including David Stark, who was an undergrad here, a couple years ago, actually did this for his senior project. He calibrated this just using the gas-rich galaxies. As you can see, basically, these things are mostly made out of gas. So it doesn't really matter what you pick the mass-light ratio of the stars to be. Stellar mass doesn't matter. So you can actually calibrate these things, and then you can ask the question, well, what mass-light ratio do I need to put these things exactly on the relation calibrated by those things. And you get a number that's actually reasonable in terms of what you expect for stellar populations. Okay. So it's kind of an iffy result. But anyway, this is a relation that one needs to understand. You can't just play around with any mass to light ratio. You also have to satisfy this kind of relation. Okay, so this was on the homework. And this is something that puzzles me still to this day. The initial explanation for why Tully-Fisher worked was that, okay, well, V squared goes GM over R, but that's not what we see, right? We see that All right? But what we observe is V4th goes as mass, velocity, right? But we can see from here that V to the fourth ought to be G squared M squared over R squared. But G is a constant, so that's no problem. But this is the same as the mass times another factor, which is the surface density. Okay, so this holds as long as the surface density M over R squared, as long as that surface density is constant. Now, when Pauli Fischer was discovered, there was a serious bias in galaxy catalogs towards the highest surface brightness galaxies, and this had led to the incorrect inference that all galaxies had the same surface brightness. Because the things that were easiest to see were the things we knew most about. And that was something called the Freeman law. That was the surface brightness. All the galaxies had the same surface brightness. And so that seemed like a good explanation for that. You got this relation, and that would match the data as long as sigma was constant. All galaxies had the same surface density, and for the same mass to light ratio, then the same surface brightness. Now, if you actually go and ask, geez, you know, turns out that the Freeman law is a selection effect. You just see the brightest galaxies first. And so what happens if you look at this relation for galaxies of different surface brightness? So you can explicitly do this, and so that's what's done here. This is a bin containing the Freeman bright galaxy. So here's the central surface brightness and the exponential fit terms, 21 things brighter than 21.2 magnitudes per square arc second in the V-band, high surface brightness. And so to my amazement, when we start adding these data, so here's the next one magnitude bin in surface brightness. You can calculate using this relation where these things should fall, and that's what these different lines are. So for each corresponding bin, corresponding colored line should give you this much of a shift. Well, the data don't seem to care about that. Okay. Everything, so far as I can tell, galaxies of all disk galaxies of all surface brightnesses fall on the same Pauli-Fischer relation, in contradiction to this argument. So this simple, straightforward argument is wrong, and if you got this far on your homework, that's why you get the scaling they say. You need to have the mass-to-light ratio and the surface brightness conspire to keep the surface density constant, which strikes me as a strange fine-tuning problem. But that's what it does. Okay, so that's a systematic that we need to understand. Another one is that the shapes of rotation curves do depend on the light distribution. Okay, so it's not just the Pauli-Fischer relation, which this just depends on. This just depends on the total mass and the sort of the global velocity. Yeah. So this is just all the light, all the gas to give you the mass. And the outermost velocity. But there's more. The shape of the rotation curve, so it's detailed shape, not just the sort of outer value, depends on not just how much light there is, but also on the distribution of light. So this is the so-called universal rotation curve from Persic and Solucci. What they did is they took 1,000 or so rotation curves, bend them up by how luminous the galaxies were, so this is the absolute magnitude, and then averaged things within the bin. So this is the average rotation curve for galaxies of this absolute magnitude, and so forth, from bright down to faint. Or equivalently, you could bend them up by circular velocity. So these are the fastest rotators, these are the slowest rotators in their sample. Now you have to be a little careful about this, because they fit the function to this, and say that predicts any rotation curve, and it doesn't work quite that well because there are real variations within a bin. So they sort of averaged over some of the information. But the general thing is true, that a bright galaxy tends to have a rotation curve that goes up, peaks, and then falls. Now, because they had so many rotation curves, I don't think they had many that were observed that far out. And this is something I argue with Sallucci every time I see him. In my experience, if you measure these things further out, they always flatten out, or as he claims, they will keep falling. But the essential point here is that there is a dependence of the shape on the rotation curve, one on luminosity. It's not just the outermost part, but the shape varies, so bright galaxies go up and fall. Faint galaxies rise slowly and are sometimes still rising at the last measured point. They haven't yet flattened out. Maybe they won't flatten out. Right? It's just sort of our empirical prejudice from studying brighter galaxies that usually they flatten out, so we sort of assume that'll eventually happen. Right? And it does in some cases, but doesn't have to. So that's one thing. But another thing is what he's plotted this here is against what he calls the optical radius, which is sort of like the exponential scale length. It's some measure of how fast the starlight falls off. If I remember right, it's basically 3 scale lengths. So something close to the edge of the disk. And so the claim here is that the velocity is a function of both the luminosity and the scale length of the disk. So that the total mass, including the dark matter, knows not just about the total light, but also how that light is distributed. Right? Because if you deconstructed this spin, you might have galaxies of the same luminosity, some of which were more compact than others, so they'd have different rotation curves in physical kiloparsecs. But when you scale by how big the disk is, then they fall on top of each other, more or less. So that's another question. Why does the dark matter know about the light distribution? There are plenty of theories in which it shouldn't.
Is there any physical, it's nice heuristically to know this happens, but is there any physical mechanism to explain why you have these relationships?
No. That's the short answer. The long answer is that lots and lots of people have tried to do this and have had varying degrees of success. But in the conventional picture, it depends on how galaxies form. So you need to know what the dark matter halo distribution is, and you need to know how the galaxy formed inside that to give you the final galaxy. Yeah.
Is the idea that the correlation of the relation probably occurred during formation and isn't important anymore? Or if we somehow managed to change the galaxy completely without changing the dark matter, would the dark matter change itself?
Oh, okay. So it's a very good question, and we don't know is the short answer. This is all stuff that what I'm presenting now for the first half of lecture are just the empirical systematics, the facts to be explained by some idea like that. It is my opinion that we don't really understand these things. The conventional approach is to presume that this is somehow set in the physics of galaxy formation. So the first thing that you suggested. But it's not clear what would happen if you did the second thing. And so maybe it's galaxy formation and evolution. But it's not obvious what the physics is that sets this. And in fact, if you do the naive thing of asking what the numerical simulations structure formation predict for the dark matter halos, and they do give you a prediction for the mass density profiles of the halos called the NFW halo. So you know what V of R is for that NFW halo. You can add a stellar disk to that, add an exponential disk, and the combination, and that would sort of be the what I would consider the naive prediction of the standard model. And galaxies don't look like that. So you have to have more physics that does something else besides just embedding an exponential disk in one of these numerical halos. But what that is, we don't know. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't catch what was weird about the picture. Why that demonstrates something?
Well, it's And maybe I'm getting my ahead of myself by saying it demonstrates anything. I'm just saying this is an empirical fact that needs to be understood. In terms of dark matter, I think it's weird that it scales with the optical radius. Okay, so that means the total dynamics, which certainly in the outer part should be dominated by the dark matter, nonetheless know about this length scale of the light.
So you're saying it's strange that even the outer parts scale with the visible light radius.
Exactly. And in fact, the claim is this is especially true for these fainter galaxies, which by most arguments, the disks are not, maximal disk doesn't work so well for these things. The stars don't contribute too much to the total. So you'd think dark matter was dominant almost everywhere. And yet, this is still true, but cares about the optical scale length.
So suppose dark matter didn't know about the light, what would you see then? What would change?
Well, so one prediction of this simple idea that I just discussed, you have a dark matter halo, you know its density profile, and one of the early ideas for galaxy formation was that the halo has some spin that it collects from torques, basically. These would be primordial torques, so the entire universe is expanding to overdensities that will become the dark matter halo, or expanding first and then contracting. When they're at their maximum extent, they can torque each other, and that gives them a little bit of net spin.
Okay.
So the halo has some angular momentum, and so the idea was that initially the baryons are just mixed in here, but they can cool and condense, as they have to do, to form a real galaxy down at the center of this thing. Okay, so the idea was that as they cool and condensed, this angular momentum was conserved,
right,
and they just can collapse by a factor that depends on that spin.
Right,
they start out with a little bit of angular momentum, but not enough, and they stop when they're centrifugally supported. And it turns out that you can simulate, ask what the typical spin is. It's order 7%, and it didn't mention was way, where centrifugal support would be 100%. So the typical galaxy collapses by about a factor of 10, or a little more, in order to become centrifugally supported. And that also nicely explains why dark matter halos are so much bigger than the galaxies they host. In that picture, you know, there is some distribution of spins. Some halos get torqued more than others. The halos that end up spinning faster have more angular momentum, so the baryons have to collapse by a smaller factor before they become centrifugally supported. So you can map between this size scale length and this initial spin, and people have actually made claims to be able to map between those distributions. The problem in this context is that for a galaxy of a given mass, the presumption is that you're talking about a halo of a proportional mass, okay, and the only thing that's varying is the spin. Well, the halo doesn't care. It has the same mass scale length. The galaxy scale length is varying because of the spin. The mass scale length is not varying. And that predicts that the rotation curve of the dark matter component should be the same for all these different galaxies. Okay, so the disk will be, for a low spin halo, will be compact. For a high spin halo, it'll be much more diffuse. Okay, but the halo is the same. And those gives you different rotation curves. It doesn't care what the optical scale length is.
But why does a halo have to be the same mass?
Well, that's an assumption that went into the model.
Oh.
And the assumption there is that if you're going to get so much starlight out of it, so much luminosity, then you need so much stellar mass, which is proportional to the baryonic mass, which is by presumption proportional to the total mass of the dark matter halo. Which seems like the obvious presumption to make. At that point, I think we can say this is wrong. It can't be proportional. Okay. But then you get back into that scaling relation with Tolle-Fisher relation, right? The mass to light ratio, m to l, the dynamical m to l now that you're measuring inside of the disk, has to somehow conspire with the surface, density, surface brightness, I guess I should say now, to keep the surface density constant. Okay.
What's that have to do with this?
Because this is basically what's going on, right? Tolle-Fisher says you have to have the same total surface density, whereas this is saying the surface densities depend on the light distribution. So it is, right, we're changing the light distribution. So one component of the mass has a different surface density. That means you have to also change the surface density of the dark matter in order to balance that out and keep this total constant. So if you're confused now, that's good. It means you're paying attention. This doesn't make any sense. So a lot of very bright people have failed to understand this. All right, so we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit in talking about the interpretation, but that's good, because we're not going to have time to do it all anyway. But these are the sort of things that we'll discuss next time, so bear in mind. Another Italian astronomer, Renzo Sanchisi, said this a long time ago, something I call Renzo's rule, that when you see a feature in the light, you see a corresponding feature in the rotation curve. So this is another way of just empirically noting that there is some kind of connection between the dynamics of the stuff you see and the overall dynamics, which are presumably dark matter dominated.
Does the corresponding change, is it the same as it would have been without the presence of dark matter, or is it like, if you saw it, for example, in solid dip in the light to mass or the light ratio, you would expect a drop in the, you know, like the rotation curve or something.
Right.
Is it like linear, or is there like some?
There is a function. It's okay. Not linear.
Okay.
And we'll get to that. Yeah.
So in this picture, the lights.
Is the that light, solid line?
Right. So the light is where at least close to the sort of center of the galaxy, where it's not.
Where it's.
Well. Where we're not out sort of in the far reaches, it's mostly dominated by the stars, right?
That's right. So maybe we should start with that example.
Even up to like up to 10 kiloparsecs is still mostly dominated by light in the flat plane.
So it depends on the surface brightness of the galaxy. So for bright galaxies, yes, they can be dominated by the stellar light a long ways out. But that's not true for the lower surface brightness galaxies. B squared goes as gm over r. By low surface brightness, we mean r is big for the stellar mass.
So let me explain the question. So what I'm saying is that if the you're saying it's weird that the light is corresponding to the features in the rotation curve, but if the only features in the light we see is close to the center, then that's not weird.
Yes, that's right. So I didn't say it was weird, did I? I'm just saying it's an empirical fact. I think it would be weird if it were far out where the dark matter.
Right.
That happens. So that part is weird, but you're absolutely right in at small radii. So let's look at this case first, where maximum just works pretty well, and this is one of the strong arguments people put forward in favor of maximum disk. So here's our friend NGC 6946 again. Here's the surface brightness profile derived from that light distribution. So K-band surface brightness is a function of radius. There's an exponential disk fit, very nice, all the way out. Except in the very center, we have that little peak of light, which is this tiny bulge, sort of 4% of the total light. Okay. So that little bulge predicts this little kink in the rotation curve at small radii. Okay. And so that's one example of Renzo's rule. That, you know, you see a feature in the light, there's a corresponding feature in the rotation curve. Okay. And so that is not weird, just as you say, provided that the stars are a dominant mass component and it happens at small radii. Now, there are people who argue, quite for good reasons, one of them being Tully Fisher, that in no case is the disk maximal. And the reason you want to do that for Tully Fisher is that then you get away from this fine tuning problem. If you make the stellar mass small enough, then it doesn't matter what its surface density is. Right? And so, really, you're just looking at the dark matter. And then you want the dark matter scale length to always be the same. But then you're okay with that. So some people use that to argue that disks are always submaximal, but then in that case, Renzo's rule is weird, even in the centers of galaxies. So you can't have it both ways. So
wait, can you
Okay. So
what are people arguing?
Okay, so they're okay, so from Tully Fisher, you have this. This is what theories. This is what Newton says. Basically, this is a rephrasing of Newton. Okay, that the velocity should depend on the mass and the radius, or the way I've written it here, the surface density. Okay. But what the data say is that you don't see any residual due to the surface brightness.
Right. Yeah.
Which is what I expected to see because of this argument. Okay. And so what can you measure? What you measure is the surface brightness of the stars. Right? So if you make the mass to light ratio of the stars small enough, then this term doesn't matter as long as this is the total mass, right? Which is really the sum of the stars and the dark matter and whatever else is there. Okay. So as long as you make this piece small enough, right, so if we can neglect that, then we're free to assert that the dark matter density is constant, and then you get back to this.
Okay.
Well, is that one of the reasons that they assume that there's a smooth smear of dark matter rather than and the clumps floating around?
I don't think so, though that would help, I guess. Well, it's a good question. I don't know offhand. Certainly a lot is presumed here. Okay. But so this, what I just said, is basically the argument that is often made in the literature for why disks are not maximal. You need to suppress that term in order to prevent there from being an obvious residual in the Tully Fisher relation that depends on the light distribution. But we see that it does depend on the light distribution in the universal rotation curve. And also here, this is the argument in favor of maximum disk, that you see this feature, it has the corresponding feature in the rotation curve, and that's only matched if most of that mass is, in fact, in the stars that you see. Right? If it's just dark matter, you can have that feature will be scaled down here, and the dark matter will do that, but it won't do that.
Can you state again, what do you mean by maximum disk or optimal disk?
Maximum disk is just scaling the mass to light ratio of the disk, so this dashed blue line here, that's the stellar disk. The solid blue line is the sum of the bulge, which is that little peaky thing in there, the disk, and the gas. So those are the individual contributions, and that's the total. But like I say, you don't know, you know the shape of the stellar distribution, so you can compute the shape of the rotation curve.
Yeah.
But you don't know its normalization. You need to know the mass to light ratio to do that.
Right.
So in any model you want to build, you are free to take that line. You're not free to change its shape, but you are free to scale it up and down. Okay. And so maximum disk is the case of scaling it up until you explain the inner part of the rotation. Okay, right? You could have scaled it way down here with a much lower mass to light ratio, but if it's down there, then you need a lot of dark matter already at small radii.
Okay, so you're scaling the mass to light ratio such that it gives a good representation of the inner stuff floating around.
And that's generally what's meant by maximum disk. That's all.
And then what is optimal? Is that the same or is it?
I never said optimal. I hope I didn't say optimal.
It did at one.
Sub-maximal maybe is just the opposite case where this is low enough.
That wouldn't occur.
That the disk contribution is down here, and then you're attributing the rest of the rotation to dark matter, even down here at small radii. And that's fine in a lot of cases, but it doesn't give you subtle features like that.
Okay. Yes, so doesn't that it doesn't give you that, disprove it?
You would think so.
So is it your opinion that it's disproved?
It is my opinion that there are a series of really challenging fine-tuning problems. Right? You need to get everything to balance out just so to make it work. Right? You can have maximum disk, but then it should have some residual of Tully-Fisher based on this argument. But as long as you fine-tune the surface density of the dark matter to counteract the surface density of the stars,
then it works. But then it doesn't work at the center, because the
Okay. And people, scientists are supposed to be objective, right? But we're people too. And so what often happens is that somebody will make one argument or another, they'll do an investigation, and their result will lead clearly to one answer. Then when they meet a conflicting result, the first reaction is, well, that's just wrong. Right?
Bad observation.
Yeah, and so there is this thing that psychologists call cognitive dissonance. And that is, you see this in our politics all the time.
Yes.
You reject facts that do not conform to your pre-existing beliefs.
Okay? Absolutely.
And that is a very hard thing to avoid. Now we should do that, or try to do that as scientists. Try to be objective and understand all the data all the time. But in practice, we're still human and we don't all do that so well. Okay. So I've heard over the past decade, the same people have the same argument about exactly these points, and they never convince each other one way or the other. So to me, it feels like a contradiction, or at the very least, a fine-tuning problem. But that's my opinion.
What could a person say to, well, here you have it, other than to deny that, you know, that this data is right, but I guess this has been done for multiple galaxies,
yeah,
so what can they say that, you know, it doesn't
work? La. I mean, that there is, people do ignore it, right? it's very frustrating, because, and people, I mean, I met Renzo early in my career, and I got to know him as a very thoughtful and careful scientist, so when he says this, I take it very seriously. And there is a personal element to that. People who came to this opposite kind of conclusion for different reasons and didn't have to know Renzo are more inclined to dismiss it off of hand, and vice versa. I mean, I actually got in an argument about Renzo over this exact interpretation because he was so used to seeing Tully-Fisher being obeyed that he, after some arguing, he said, "Tully-Fisher is God!" Right? Because everything always falls on Tully-Fisher. And I said, "Newton is God!" And they're not the same thing. Right? And that's the problem in a nutshell. The data is not.
So you have Newtonian astrophysicists and Tully-Fisher astrophysicists.
And that was a good kind of argument, because we both learned something and changed our minds a little bit. Because I had come to the problem this way, so I was arguing to him that disks had to be submaximal, and so I didn't appreciate what I just showed you until we had that argument. And he didn't appreciate that Tully-Fisher was not such an obvious problem, because empirically he was just used to it working. But not all arguments end so profitably. Now there are cases where Renzo's rule applies even where the dark matter should dominate. So as Lev points out absolutely correctly, it's not a problem in here where you can say the disk is maximal. This is the best example, or at least the most obvious example. I've seen similar examples, but this is the strongest one. where you see a feature far out where the dark matter should be dominant. So you see a bit of this shape in here, but it's not well resolved. I should remake this plot. There are better data now, but they show this more clearly. But what those new data confirm is this kink here, which has been known for a long time now in this galaxy. And that kink is reflected in the gas distribution. Now, this is one of these gas-dominated galaxies, so the stars sort of do this part, and the gas does most of this part out here. And so you see that kink in the gas distribution, and you see it reflected in the overall dynamics. Now, if you look at this, how velocities add in quadrature over here, right? V of the gas here is what, 40 kilometers, 30 kilometers a second, whereas the total is up above 60 or so over here, right? So 30 squared doesn't come anywhere close to 60 squared. So most of the velocity support out here has to be dark matter. That dark matter is presumed to be in a spherical halo, right? It's tempting to put it in a disk and to say that the dark matter happens to follow exactly the shape of the disk, and that's one of the arguments in favor of cold molecular gas. Remember, we talked about that as an outside possibility for the dark matter. So in that picture, you would put all of the dark matter here in the disk, and then the cold gas follows the H1 that you see, and so that comes out naturally. The problem with putting it all in the disk is stability. Right? You can't make it stable disk unless the dark matter is in a spherical halo. If you put the dark matter in a spherical halo, then the dark matter dominates and it shouldn't care about whatever the little flaky gas is doing, and you should expect its feature to be smooth. And we can ask what Lev asked, well, how do you explain this in that kind of picture? It's a transient feature. It comes and goes. It just happens to look that way. Smart people have said that to me.
Well, it's possible if there's only like one example of it.
This is the strongest example, that's right. So it is possible. But as I'll show you, there's a mapping that shouldn't necessarily work in a transient picture. Usually there's not any strong feature in the gas, so you don't get to do this experiment very many times. Because gas is collisional. So you would expect the feature itself to be temporary. However, it's fairly long-lived, many giga-years. So.
Don't hold your breath.
Well, yeah, you're not going to see it evolve, that's for sure. Not in your own lifetime. Okay, so if we go back to this argument that a lot of people like to make, that the lack of any surface brightness dependence in Tully-Fisher is telling you that the stellar surface density is not important ever, it's all dark matter density. I just recently cooked up this test for this, and so if you look at a rotation curve, you can measure the velocity at some outer point, V flat, but you could also measure it at some other point. Some people argue this is the thing to do, because this is kind of arbitrary depending on how far out you've managed to go. I say it's not that arbitrary, because as long as you go far enough out, you see it's flat. It doesn't matter, but, another way to do it is to measure the peak at where the measure the total velocity at where the disk contribution should peak. So that's the maximum contribution that the stars are making. Okay. For an exponential disk, that's at 2.2 scale lengths. Okay. And so that's what I call this R peak, in this the radius where the baryonic contribution peaks. That is for a pure exponential disk. You can actually solve, as we've done before, for the detailed shape and ask where the peak really is, rather than just assuming it's an exponential. And so that's what I've done here. So again, each point is one galaxy, same galaxies that are on Tully Fisher that I've shown you. So the velocity now is this velocity measured at this thing, but it's the total velocity, which is what we can measure by the light distribution tells us where the baryonic contribution should peak, but of course it doesn't tell us the amplitude of the scaling by m to l. So we're just choosing to measure the peak at that radius, and as I've drawn it, that's the same as V flat. And that's not always the case because of the bright galaxies do that, the faint galaxies do that. However, I've drawn it in an exaggerated sense. When you actually go and do this, they're usually within 10% of each other. They're not all that different. Okay. But, that's the way other people say I should do it, so I can do it that way. All right, so this quantity, V squared R over RP, that's the acceleration due to everything at that point. All right, that's basically what Newton is telling you the acceleration is. It's minus grad V, all those useful things, right? So this is the force per unit mass. Okay? And that force is due to the sum of baryons and dark matter. Okay? So the argument over here was that the baryons don't matter to this. Okay? So if that is right, then I would not expect a correlation here. Because this is now the baryonic surface brightness. Okay, so that is, I've included the gas mass, so it's the baryonic surface density. But it's essentially the surface brightness of these things. And you can see there's a pretty good correlation. So the overall, that's just another empirical way of saying that the overall gravitational force does know about the mass distribution of the disk. So a high surface brightness disk has a lot of density. It has a high acceleration at this point. Low surface brightness disk, low acceleration, a much lower point. But this isn't one-to-one. I mean, if it were just stars, then in fact this acceleration would just be g times the surface density. Right, because V squared goes as gm over r, so V squared over r goes as gm over r squared. Which m over r squared is a surface density. Okay. So not only would you expect in the Newtonian case there to be this correlation if there's no dark matter at all, but you would predict that it's a one-to-one correlation, and the slope of this should be one, the way I've plotted it. It's not. The slope is about a half. Okay. Yeah. Cool, huh? Not expected. And so what that says is if these brightest things, say, are maximal, and that depends on exactly what m to l you choose, but you have to get systematically less maximal as you go to lower and lower surface brightness. So these things are more dark matter dominated than those things. And it is well established in the literature, thanks to me, that low surface brightness galaxies are dark matter dominated at most radii. A lot of times people get sloppy about this and say, well, low surface brightness galaxies are dark matter dominated, meaning that's true everywhere. And the more proper statement is that the radius where you clearly need dark matter sets in sooner in lower surface brightness systems. So these high surface brightness systems, maximum disk explains a good ways out before you finally flatten out enough, you for sure need dark matter. But as you go down in surface brightness, the dark matter becomes important at a smaller and smaller radius in the system. Huh. Yes, sir.
So that 2.2 scaling no longer applies?
That's where this is being measured, right?
Right.
So I'm not sure what you mean by no longer applies.
We use the 2.2 scaling to be where dark matter became dominant, unless I'm missing something.
Okay, no, that's just a choice so that if we had a galaxy with the same rotation curve, say, in a different, which doesn't happen, but of a different surface brightness, and it would have our peak in a different place.
Oh, okay.
And so V peak might be different.
So it's just the empirical number we're using.
Yeah, it's just a choice of where to measure this velocity.
Okay.
So where dark matter becomes dominant does depend on surface brightness. And so that'll be fewer scale lengths in a low surface brightness galaxy. And I've chosen the mass to light ratio here based on somebody's population synthesis model, so this is a purely empirical thing. You can redo this for different choices of mass to light ratio, and it moves around the details, but the basic correlation persists.
Yes?
I just want to clarify, like, so if you expected the dark matter to kick in at the same scaling, it should be like flat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So if this if this argument were right, such that things are dark matter dominated everywhere, then the only thing that matters is the dark matter surface density, and I would not expect any correlation with stellar surface density. So I would have expected this to be a scatter diagram. And finally, you're asking about the mapping between the luminous mass distribution and the total. It turns out there is one that is something called this mass discrepancy acceleration relation. That's what I call it. So you can take the ratio at each point along the rotation curve. So now these are, each point here is one point along the rotation curve. Right, so you measure this at some resolution, and you also measure the light distribution, which tells you something like that. Okay, and so you can figure out what the mass discrepancy is. So this is squared here because mass goes as v squared, right? So this is basically the ratio of total mass enclosed by one of these points to stellar mass. Include the gas too, but it doesn't matter too much except out here. Okay. So at each point, you ask what the velocity due to the what the total velocity is, and how much velocity you can attribute to the stars. And again, you can play this game for lots of different mass to light ratios, and you get the same answer with slightly different numbers. And so that correlates with either the surface density or the acceleration, this v squared over r, but not at rp, just at each r that's actually measured. So this is a local relation now instead of a global one. Okay. And so what you see is that there's basically no mass discrepancy at high accelerations, which is high surface densities. So that's maximum disk at the very centers of galaxies. Okay, you don't need dark matter in where the accelerations are high. And you can make this plot against radius, and it's a mess, right? It's a scatter relation. There's a bit of a trend, but it's nowhere near as tight as this. So there's something magic about the acceleration scale that you only need dark matter around this scale of about 10 to the minus 10 meters per second per second. That is, if you look everywhere in the universe where we need dark matter, we never need it above this scale. So the solar system, you know, is about 8 orders of magnitude above this scale. So you don't need dark matter to explain anything in the solar system. And it's only when you get down to this incredibly tiny scale that you start to notice the need for dark matter. Yeah?
If the acceleration is a tracer of radius, and why is it a scatter plot when you change acceleration to radius? Shouldn't it stay the same?
No, because the acceleration is v squared over r. Right, so this is the centrifugal force that you need to keep a particle on its orbit.
So it's not entirely, it's not just a relation between how close you are to the center.
No, that's right. That's right. And so that's an idea many people had initially, and some still do, is that you go further out and you're more dark matter dominated. That simple relation doesn't work. It depends not on the length scale, but on this acceleration scale. So, for example, a bright galaxy, which is high surface brightness, lives over on the right side of this plot, And it's not until you go out to very, very large radius that you start to see the need for dark matter. But one of these low surface brightness galaxies has low acceleration everywhere, and so you infer that you need a lot of dark matter even already at very small radii. So it's not the length scale that matters, it's this surface density scale, or equivalently an acceleration scale, which is A equals G C. There's more than that. It's not just that the mass discrepancy sets in close to this particular acceleration scale, but it varies systematically with that, right? So the amount of dark matter that you need depends on the acceleration relative to the baryons, right? So if you can measure how much baryons there are, you can predict how much dark matter you need. Just empirically, you can fit a line or some kind of polynomial to that, whatever you want to call it. Even when the baryons are very subdominant, so here, you know, factor of 6, 8, almost 10 times as much mass in dark matter than baryons, nonetheless, all you need to know to predict the total rotation curve, dominated as it is by dark matter, all you need to know is the distribution of the baryons. You ask what the surface brightness of the distribution, what the surface brightness of the stars is, and at that surface brightness you say, oh, I need this much dark matter. Okay, so the two components really know about each other very well. That's what this relation is telling you. Okay. And it's not at all, yeah, it's bizarre. So why should, if dark matter is most of the mass here, why should it care what the baryon distribution is? Makes no friggin' sense. And so that brings us to the end, which is good, because the next part is the really crazy stuff, which is what we'll discuss next time. Maybe I'll do this very quickly at the beginning of next time, because there's not much. But the idea of MOND, which is what you'll read about, or at least a discussion about it, the simple idea is that instead of having dark matter, you change the force law in a really bizarre way, but at this particular acceleration scale. And then the reason the two are connected is because it's what the force law says it should. Okay, so we will discuss that next time.